Welcome to Take the Forest Path podcast. This is the place for unique and creative guided meditations, as well as the exploration of various topics on the journey to our true selves and our true purpose. Hello, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Katarina, and I'm here today with Dr. Frances Martinez. Hey, Frances. So, Frances is a naturopathic doctor and she's also a counselor. She focuses on helping adult women heal who are going through life transitions, dealing with difficult coping mechanisms, such as anxiety, wanting to process past traumas, and healing past generational traumas in order to become the best versions of themselves. And her work focuses on using trauma-informed tools such as nervous system regulation and somatic therapy, which is what we're going to talk about. And I'm so excited because I also used, you know, nervous system regulation tools and theories like that in my practice, but I know that you are more of an expert on this and you do a lot of like the somatic therapy, which is really what I wanted to kind of discuss and talk about with you. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Thank you for having me. Nervous system and somatic therapy is definitely my forte. I love talking about it. It's my favorite subject. So yeah, I'm really excited to dig in.
Nice. How did you get into like the somatic therapy, kind of nervous system, you know, all of that?
Yeah, totally. So like anyone, I feel like that comes into this kind of technique and therapy. I feel like, of course, you have your own trauma, your own stuff, mental health stuff that has happened. But definitely I feel like I had been going to therapy for a while, like a couple years for sure. And I feel like I needed more and it wasn't truly, definitely therapy was great. And it gave me so much awareness, gave me so much, be able to like understand, what was going on like with me and like, just mental health wise. But yeah, like I said, I needed more to the point that I feel like there wasn't a change for my body. Like I was still experiencing anxiety. I was still experiencing certain like even physical elements happening in my body. Like I was having acid reflux at like 20 years old, like throughout all my undergrad and medical school. And that's really young. That's like something usually happens, you think like in the 50s, 60s, you're having acid reflux or really bad digestive issues. And it was a lot of physical elements happening. And my anxiety was just kind of, I'm not saying getting worse, but it wasn't getting better. And so I think finding somatic therapy and nervous regulation kind of validated all my experiences and also kind of got to the root of, I need to work with the body instead of just the mind and not just talk about it logically, but more go inside and inward and feeling, what is happening? What is my body trying to tell me? And I feel like that's when there was a change and I got super excited because it was almost like an answer to what I was going through. And so, yeah, I just got really into it, dig deep, did more courses, did more certifications. And yeah, I became kind of like a fanatic just because how impactful it is, but also impactful for me and my healing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, I have a similar story. I love what you said about how you had gone through therapy and you, this is what I sort of experienced too, which was a validating feeling around, oh my gosh, so it's not really all in my head. I mean, it really is the mind-body connection.
It is, yeah.
And so I learned about this while we were in naturopathic school together at Bastyr. And that's what I love about our naturopathic training, because we learn foundationally that the mind and body is connected and you can't really separate it. And I feel like all of the therapies we learned were supported by that foundation. But we also had opportunities to take, which was what we did, right? We took other mind body courses and we learned about the polyvagal theory. So we want to talk about this because I think that one, this concept, we were just talking about this earlier, is it can definitely be confusing. Like, it took me a while to actually understand what was going on, but it was so powerful for me because it, like you were saying, I mean, it validated my experiences, which is that I had a big problem. I think it showed up mostly, honestly, in school. So we were in school for so long, undergrad and then graduate school. And I definitely had, which we'll talk about, but the fight or flight responses in so many of my classes. I mean, even just, there used to be a time where raising my hand would put me into the fight or flight. And yeah. It was one of those things that I felt so terrible about myself because before I knew about this, my inner dialogue was telling me that, what is wrong with you? I mean, you've been in school for how long? Why are you afraid to ask this question? And I would, especially siblings, I feel like I have a really supportive family and they would always tell me, well, you just have to not care what people think. Yeah. And I feel like that's a pretty common thing for friends, yeah. You know, do you just have to not care what people think? And there was a time where I was like, I don't know if I do care on a conscious level. I don't know if I do care, but this nervous system response is still acting up and it's seriously impacting how I'm communicating and what I'm learning even.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's more about inward, right? Not yeah. even about external factors. I think it's more about us.
Yes. And our perceptions. So I'll go over very briefly, and trying to make it as concise as possible so people can understand what the polyvagal theory is, what it means. And then I'll have you jump in because I know that you can probably add things to it. So the polyvagal theory, in essence, is basically just a theory that explains how our nervous system is broken down into a predictable hierarchy, which automatically reacts to the world around us and our perceptions of our experiences. So it's doesn't have anything to do with our rational thinking brain. It's automatically switched on when we experience what our nervous system detects as danger. So that's important because it's our thinking actually is not even online with the system. So this system is more, do they call it mammalian? Like this is something like our natural instincts in a way. Exactly. We were born with it. Yeah, we don't learn it. And from the time we're born, I mean, probably from the time we're in the womb, this nervous system is basically detecting, am I safe? Is this person safe? Is this environment safe or is it not? And when it detects that something is not safe, the first, so it'll attach onto cues. And these are sometimes cues that, again, rationally, we're not even aware of, but it will detect a cue that it deems, perceives as not safe. And the first hierarchy that it goes down to is a fight or flight response, which I feel like a lot of people have heard of. Mm-hmm. So that's the sympathetic nervous system activated. This is where your heart rate's going to increase. This is where your breathing is going to become really rapid and shallow. This is where all the blood goes into your muscles. So it's literally preparing you to fight something or to flee. And this is also something that people don't talk about, but I think it's so important. When we're in the fight or flight, we start to misread people's cues. So I just listened to something that Stephen Porges, who came up with this theory, I'm pretty sure, right?
Correct.
Okay, yeah, so he was
1994.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it wasn't even that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he was talking about how when you're in the fight or flight, you actually misread people's faces even, and you start to not be able to recognize a facial expression of safety, and you actually are more likely to recognize, like, for example, a fearful face as an angry face. So the connection, you're not actually able to connect with people like you are if you are in the parasympathetic rest or digest state, which is when your nervous system deems everything as safe. So once you go into this fight or flight, the purpose of it, obviously, is to fight your way out of this danger or to run away from it. And if you're able to do that, the natural process is that you will hopefully be able to get into a safe environment so you can go back up to the rest and digest state, which is also the connection state where we can have genuine connections with people. If you're not able to get out of this situation, so you're not able to fight it, you're not able to flee, then we go into another hierarchy state, which is the freeze state, which also not really commonly known is a branch of the parasympathetic, and it's called the dorsal vagal. And so this is kind of the classic example is the possum that's on the road and a car comes by and it plays dead. It automatic, so it shuts down and it pretends that it's dead. We do that on the same level. And so this is actually our heart rate goes down again. We dissociate. This is very much a trauma response, right? Where
exactly.
We cannot move. I mean, we cannot think. It's kind of like almost like curling up, symbolically like curling up in the fetal position. And we wait it out. We basically like wait the danger out. That's the purpose of it. And then we have to go back up the hierarchy to get into the parasympathetic rest and digest state again. And again, these responses are not voluntary. So that's the biggest thing, is that we can become aware once we're in the states, but often we still won't know what cues. Sometimes we can have awareness, but oftentimes we don't even know the cues that put us in the state. So this is like a natural, this is completely natural way that our nervous system assesses dangers and keeps us alive, basically. The problem is when people get really stuck in fight or flight, or the freeze, or they're bouncing back and forth, and they're not able to assess enough cues in their environment or the people around them or within themselves that say that they're safe. And so they are not able to get back into parasympathetic, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect. Perfectly okay. Well said. That's like a great summary. Goes into a little bit of everything, a little summary of everything. Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, and I think I wanted to also highlight that, yeah, like you were saying, that the parasympathetic, we learn, you know, sympathetic, parasympathetic. And like you said, actually parasympathetic. I think that was like the new nuance of like, oh, it's actually two, like there are two like divisions of it. And there is the ventral vagal, which is safety and social, which is what everybody thinks of parasympathetic. That's where you're able to connect with people. That's where you're able to feel relaxed and calm. And that's the state that, you know, that's where we want to be. But then the other part of this parasympathetic is the dorsal vagal, which is the shutdown freeze response, which is a totally normal protective part of our body, right? And so I think it's really important to know that there's two of them, because we don't ever think about that. And also with the dorsal vagal, I feel like there's a lot of shame around that as well, of, oh, I just froze, or I didn't do anything, I didn't respond a certain way. And I think it's really important to know that everybody reacts very differently to a trigger, a traumatic event, something that's happening to them. And freezing and not reacting is a protector part. It's normal. It's this nervous system is doing it just as, you know, just how to breathe. It's the same kind of concept. So I just wanted to touch on that part, that shame. There's so much shame around the dorsal vagal part. And then like you were saying, also getting stuck in one of these states is, I would say, like, what is kind of almost wrong, what happens, what goes wrong, right? Because this is totally normal, right? We need these states in our everyday life because we need to live, we need to survive, right? What if, you know, you get, if you're trapped in a situation and you need to get away from the threat, totally normal circumstance, you need to get into the fight, or maybe you do need to get in the freeze and shut down to live, to survive. So these are totally normal things that need to happen. But like you were stating, that once you get stuck in one of these states is when the trouble happens, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's such an important part, which is that there is a lot of shame and guilt around the freezing response. Mm-hmm. And that is interesting because I think it is a little different than the fight or flight. So I feel like in our culture, now I didn't think we would talk about this, but I think this is fascinating and so important, is that a lot of cultures, not every culture, but I do think that in America especially, we kind of see the fight or flight, or we have traditionally, as sort of a good thing, because honestly, it kind of gets things done. I mean, think of these people who are workaholics, and America has been built sort of on this American dream, like if you work hard enough, you can make your dreams come true. And I'm not saying that everybody who works hard is in fight or flight. No way. But I do think that there are a lot of parallels where, for example, I mean, being a student, right? I could always work harder. I always had this feeling that if I didn't if I failed an exam or something, well, that was completely my fault because I could always study more. I could have pulled it an all-nighter. And oftentimes for me to pull an all-nighter, I kind of had to be in fight or flight. You know, I mean, I couldn't be in this relaxed, belly breathing state. I had to be in this, you know, drinking Red Bulls and increased heart rate and alert and hypervigilant. And so I don't think that we have as much shame around that. But the freeze response, which is actually, it's such an important part of our nervous system. And it also is a part of our nervous system that only activates when we can't get out of fight or flight. So when you're in the freeze, I feel like that is really when you need the opposite of a shaming response more than any of the other states, right? 100%. Like to get back, you need compassion. You need a complete, you know, like a lot of times Stephen Porges talked about what did he call it? Now I have to look back. Just co-regulation, which is basically that to get us out of
people.
Yes. Yeah. So we need to kind of oftentimes, or it's helpful, it helps us get out of these states is when we feel that someone else has a very open, compassionate, safe demeanor about them and regulated nervous system. And then that helps us get out. And so this shame kind of, it's almost like a spiral where we'll get into it. We'll feel shame about it. Sometimes we isolate ourselves from other people. We don't put ourselves around people who can sort of help us get out of that. And so then we kind of stay in that state. And that's also, where our then over time, the concept is that over time, our system, like you were saying, gets wired between fight, flight, and freeze. And it almost like, it gets really used to that. And it's just like exercising. You almost have to exercise the parts of our nervous system that will get us up into parasympathetic. So I guess that's why breath work. And so that's what I think we do as coaches and counselors. Mm-hmm. If we know about this, like in our practices, we help people rewire that and to put practices into their lives so that they can start to rewire it. So is that where, tell me a bit about somatic therapy and how that sort of fits in this theory.
Yeah, totally. I think nervous regulation and somatic practices go hand in hand. Like they are very parallel to each other. And like you were saying with this, the polyvagal theory, I see it as a ladder. A lot of people have different representations of it, but I see it as a ladder. So like we were talking before that in order, like if you are in the freeze and shutdown, that is like the low, like we call it like the lower state of the ladder. And then in order to get even to a more calm, but safety social that we were talking about ventral vagal, you do have to go to the flight and fight state and then go up to safety and social. And so I think when you're talking about being in the freeze and shutdown and you were kind of explaining it, that is, we see that as depression, right? We see that as just being numb. You are just exhausted. That could be burnout. There could be so many like symptoms and clinical way to see it, right? But in order to get out of that, a lot of people, I think, say, oh, just go out for a run. Go do this. Go do that. Because that's what works for them, right? But in that state, like if you think about depression, no one wants to go for a run, a hike, or do that specifically, right? So in order to get out of freeze and shutdown, you have to do something that works for you. And it has to be very, almost like low stakes, right? Like if that means just doing like breath work that you could do in your bed, right? Mm-hmm. Or if that means like just being able to scream into a pillow because you're just so angry, you know, about that or whatever you're feeling, right? The nervous system actually gets, we call a vagus nerve that maybe we could talk a little bit about also, gets activated by singing, humming, chanting, gargling. So if that's very like a low reinforcement that you can do, right? Instead of going out for a run, because when you're in the flight and fight, that's when you have all this movement in your body that you're like, okay, I need to release this, right? That's the kind of, like, you have this adrenaline, all these hormones pumping through your body, that's when maybe you should go for a run. That's when you should go, like, another tool that I use is push against the wall, you know, kind of just release all that.
Release the pent-up energy in your muscles. Oh, exactly. I love that. Exactly. It's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then that's in order how you could get to the ventral vagal, which is safety, social connection, you know? So it's, and then somatic tools, like we say, are very hand in hand with that, because we're talking about listening to your body and what does your body need. And you're supposed to go inward, not almost have a curiosity, I think, about, not like logically, just don't even think logically what you're supposed to be doing, mm-hmm. anything like that, more about just what does it feel inside your body? Is there tension? What's the sensation? What's the temperature? Maybe it's a visual, like it could just be like a blob of something in my chest, right? Like just anything. It could be imagery, and just really be curious about what is it trying to tell you? What does it need at that moment, right? And that's how we go inward and do more somatic therapy, somatic experiencing. We're speaking about the body. And then I also use the nervous system regulation tools, because sometimes it means like, okay, in order to release this tension that I have, I do need to go for a run. Yeah. Or right now, I just need to maybe put something like a heated blanket, a weighted blanket, you know, that feels comforting, that feels safe. So it's really about understanding what you need in that moment, instead of doing what you think other people are telling you to do. That would make you feel better.
I love that. And I think it's so helpful for people, because even though these systems are running on autopilot, and again, like you were saying, our rational thinking doesn't really change them. There still is a part with when we're trying to rewire this and just heal from this. Our narrative plays a big part in what is actually effective for us. So for example, like you were saying, I think a lot of people, when they are experiencing depression, they're feeling really down. And a lot of us, I mean, I'm talking from experience too, when I was like this, I wanted to retreat. But I did it, but there was a bit of shame around that. And I feel like I did hear from more people that, well, no, you just have to get yourself out there. And so even when I would sometimes retreat, I think that my narrative around it was that I was being weak, which probably which is not safe, right? And so I don't think it allowed my nervous system to go back up as well into parasympathetic, versus somebody who hears this and it makes sense. It gives them permission in a way to go and do and lie under, you know, a weighted blanket and say, hey, I just need this time by myself to, you know, be by themselves for a bit, do some breath work. Do some humming, like creative things are actually really good too. There's this book called Burnout, by Emily and I want to make sure I get this right. So Emily and Amelia Nagasaki, and it's called Burnout, the Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. And honestly, the first chapter in that book is absolutely phenomenal, even if that's all you read. And they talk about a couple different ways that you can go up the ladder, like you were saying, to parasympathetic. And one of them was creative things that actually like really feed your soul. And when you're in the freeze response, I think if you have something, even if it's something that you enjoyed in childhood, but you've sort of lost touch with, revisiting that and doing it by yourself, I think can be, and doing something not forcing yourself to do it, but find an activity that you can actually sort of get lost in, and it brings up that sort of childhood joy, can be so helpful to help kind of, really what it does is it just sort of proves to your nervous system that your body, your nervous system, that you're in a safe environment. And that's what's so interesting about this. Yeah. Is that it's not, again, like we can think, I know that I'm in a safe environment. I know that probably this is not going to happen. But if our body's not feeling it, this is what you were saying about the somatics, which is so powerful, is it's teaching our body to feel that we are in safe, because that is what is going to cue the nervous system. It's not our thinking. Weirdly enough,
Yep, exactly. Right? And that's why I think how I said in the beginning, I was doing talk therapy and it definitely was great. And I could like logically have awareness and all this stuff, but it was still there. And I think that's where the vagus nerve, which is based on the polyvagal theory, but we have a vagus nerve that runs all the way from our brain down to our large intestine. And that vagus nerve is almost like, it's like a freeway of like our emotions and thoughts. So, and then what I think the most like astonishing thing about that is that 80% of the time, our sensations and feelings and everything we're feeling in our body, that's where it starts, goes up to our brain 80% of the time. And only 20% of it is going from our mind, like our thoughts, to our body. So wow. If 80% of the time it starts in our body, we need to start feeling what's going on in our body in order to change our mind, to change our thinking. And you know, a lot of people are like, you just have to change your mindset. You have to think positively, but that's only 20% of the time. So how much is it really helping? So that's why I think, especially if you've gone through traumatic event and you are in this like triggering states or survival states, it's super, super important to start with the body and being really curious about what's going on in your body in order to change not only what you're feeling, but also your thoughts, your logical thinking.
Your narrative. That's how,
your narrative, because that's how your body works. So like when you're thinking about the shame, that's how it starts. You have to think about what's going on in your body. And it's funny that you're mentioning creative expression, doing something creative that was very nourishing to you as a child, because a lot of the work that I do is a lot of inner child healing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the trauma, a lot of the stuff that has happened to us is usually in our childhood. It just happens, right? We absorb, we're a sponge at that time. So a lot of things happen to us, especially so much trauma associated with our caregivers, right?
Yeah.
Our parents, caregivers, that they don't realize sometimes that could have been traumatizing for us and really shapes us. And in adulthood, we have gone through all our childhood and adulthood, it starts showing up in different ways, right?
Yeah.
And this could be like you're saying, like perfectionism. This could be being high achieving. This could be some anxiety. It turns into anxiety, just so many things. But so we almost have to sometimes go back to our childhood and see what was helpful then, what made us happy. And that kind of just nourishes us, makes us feel safe, because it's like we're going back to our childhood and be like, what did you need at that time? What was it, what was needed that could have helped you in that moment? And sometimes a lot of those creative expressions, like if you think about, it's play, right? It's drawing, it's playing with paint, playing with toys, it's literally paint, it's play. So that's what feels nourishing and feels good to you and kind of helps us get out of this survival state.
Yeah, and I have also experienced, this is actually so interesting, a lot of times, honestly, most of the time with my clients, when we kind of work through triggers, stressors, their obstacles, what ends up happening after a while is they start to naturally gravitate towards wanting to do more creative things, especially things that really brought their attention or caught their attention when they were younger. And it's like a natural thing that occurs, I notice. Like they're, you know, I love creative stuff. I can, you know, I've always sort of been inclined to engage in creative things. So sometimes I'll, you know, if I see that someone gravitates toward that, sometimes I'll be like, oh, you know, maybe you could do this, or if we're talking about homework, but sometimes I don't, right? And it literally just comes up in them. And it's like across the board, almost everyone, once they work through, you know, those nervous system defenses, once they start to rewire their nervous system, they kind of naturally gravitate towards that.
Exactly. Because I think it's a sign of safety.
Yeah.
It is. Because you are in this way of being able to express yourself, being able to be creative. Like we said, your logical reasoning brain, when you're in those states, is offline. So you can't be creative. You can't be reasonable. You can't do any of that stuff. So that's when the creative comes on.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you think about it, when you're hypervigilant because you are assessing your surroundings, you know, because you think it's dangerous, how are you supposed to then sit down and like allow this creative flow? And it's impossible, exactly. Really.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny that you even mentioned that, because I have always said, I'm not creative. I'm not a creative person. Yeah. And I've always told that to my friends and everyone. I'm like, I'm always so just logical, da, da, da. But then, you know, here it happens. You start healing and you start getting curious and you're like, oh, actually, this is fun. I can do this, da, da, da. And you could, it's almost like you're kind of being yourself in this creative, more authentic way.
Yeah.
So interesting.
I almost feel like creativity is just us expressing our authentic being. Literally. Yeah. I think every single person is creative in their own way. It is just being able to tap into their authenticity and then expressing it the way that they want to.
100%. Yeah.
And most of us, we're talking about the nervous system, and this is tied in with conditioning, like you were saying, because as kids, we naturally get conditioned. Yep. And most of us, if not all of us at some point, felt like being our authentic self, of expressing something that was very genuine to us, was not accepted. And so what happens, and this is completely normal, honestly, like I don't think, you know, I do think that there are probably some ways that we as a culture could mitigate this from happening as much, but this happens to everybody. Like we all experience something because it's our own perception. So even if, let's say like we're with another person as a child and we wanted to, really excited about expressing something and that person didn't react the way that we thought they would. We don't really know what's going on in that person's head. I mean, they could have thought, wow, that's really cool. But for some reason, maybe they had something else going on. So for some reason, the way that they acted, we perceived as they did not accept us. And that is, as a child, when you can't take care of yourself, that is the most threatening thing that can happen to you if your community doesn't accept you. And so what do? You naturally start to push that part of you away, basically. And that becomes not safe. I mean, our nervous system goes into fight or flight, freeze, whatever, you know, ends up happening. And then that pattern sticks with us until we're able to become aware of it.
And then it shows up in adulthood. And here we have perfectionism, people-pleasing tendencies. Yeah. It's just because we needed them. We needed them in order to survive. But I think that's really important to say that they were there to help us survive, to help us cope in that moment. But then once you get to adulthood and you're like, this isn't helping me anymore.
Yeah.
So now let's try to be curious and see, where did this come from? Let's go into our inner child. Let's listen to our bodies and accept that we don't need them anymore. Be grateful that they were there. And now let's just get curious on how and what we needed when we were at that time, whenever that traumatic event happened. And then that's when either you get curious about what exactly you needed to hear, or maybe it's like what we're talking about, the stress cycle or the nervous system regulation. It's maybe a movement that it needs to end this like stress cycle, pretty much, to end this, give it almost like a finale to get released out of your body.
Yeah. And so what do you do? Because I know that for a lot of people, being able to feel their body, like really go inwards and pay attention to it, can feel really unsafe.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of tips for that, or how to sort of ease into it? Because like, it's obviously so important to be able to do that.
Yeah.
On the nervous system level. But again, I mean, the fact of the matter is that for most of us, it's not very safe to feel into our body, for most of us. And then of course there's varying degrees of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Very, very, very true. And yeah, like many people sometimes avoid feeling in their body because sometimes it could be too hard. But I think my favorite technique, it's called a pendulation, so like a pendulum that swings back and forth. I absolutely love it. It's, and some, like what I tell a lot of my patients as well, when they're first starting out, is don't go to, if you've had multiple traumas or anything, that is intense, right? Or even if you've had one trauma, think about it as a, bring it in like 20% if you can, kind of contain the event in your mind and your body and the sensations, because sometimes it could be too overwhelming and we don't want to go there without having the ability to go back to a calm state, right? So we say bring 20% of that feeling, sensation, or event up in your body and just kind of be there with it a little bit, feel where it's at, feel the sensation, feel the temperature, just be with it. And then go to your fingertips, go to your toes, and see how there's not really like a feeling there. It's kind of like calm state feeling. It's not much sensation there, right? So you could feel what it feels to be less like in this state, right? Less that intense feeling, to feel how it could feel a little bit calm. And then once you're there, let's go back inwards to where it was feeling, that feeling of tension and activated, right? Let's go to that. And then you keep going back and forth. That's why it's a pendulum, going back and forth. And then eventually it just kind of gets lessened and lessened and lessened, and it doesn't feel as overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just like a small little technique to help you how your nervous system is supposed to react, right? It's mm-hmm. supposed to help you go into this state because it's you're trying to survive a threat. But then the point is getting unstuck of those states and going back to a social and neutral state of mind and being, right? That's what it's supposed to be. And if you give your body some cues of that it's possible to do that, you're able to be regulated. You're able to go to a state that is for survival and then go back to a regulated state. It's like a memory, right? It's a practice. So that's a small technique to show you that you can go from an activated state to a more calm state and going back and forth.
Mm, that's amazing. Yeah. It's almost like teaching yourself how to be flexible,
mm-hmm,
or how exactly. the nervous system to be able to kind of go in between these states. Because I think, yeah, that's what's important, is that it's the stress is not, and the stress response is not actually the enemy. We have mm-hmm. to have that. If we don't, yeah. we are in trouble.
We would die.
Yeah, that's why it was adapted, right? Yeah. There's no way we can't live without it. It's our friend. Oh, that's the thing, I think. It can be our friend and not our enemy. But I think we've, you know, over time, especially people who have a lot of anxiety and burnout and depression, I mean, it's kind of like become their enemy, because like you were saying, I mean, at some point it has sort of turned against us, but eradicating it is not the solution. It's actually befriending it.
Yeah.
I never really thought of it that way, but I like that. Mm-hmm. Where it's
And I think befriending it comes with to me, the first step is like being validated. Whatever you're experiencing is a totally normal instinctual process, right? And mm-hmm. I think befriending it and making sure you're validated, I think that's like the first step that everybody needs to hear, for it to feel, oh, it's okay, it's safe mm-hmm. for me to be feeling this way. It's not, it doesn't almost make you an identity. Mm-hmm. You are not this person, right? And I also teach a lot from the internal family systems. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I am. And I want to hear more about it, because so I took this Jungian coaching program from Creative Mind. I absolutely loved it. So a lot of my work is around shadow work and Jungian perspective of shadow ego, but it marries with this nervous system polyvagal theory mm-hmm. so well. That is one reason why I love it, because I'm like, yeah, you know, to me that just validates that we're on the right track when all of these theories fit together. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, in that program did IFS. And so and sometimes they would incorporate it, because we would practice on each other and they would incorporate it into the sessions. And I loved it. I thought it was so cool. So tell me, what were you going to say about it? Tell us a bit about that.
So I think it's really interesting, because it's so amazing to me that all these different therapists, healers, everything, have their own version of the same thing. To me, even the polyvagal nervous system, IFS, you know, Jungian theory, they all kind of have the same concept. They just have different names for it and have a little tweaks, right?
Exactly.
But they're all kind of the same to me. But IFS, I think, is also very beautiful, and it's very similar to a lot of indigenous practices, a lot of spiritual practices. Wow. So there is a lot of backlash to Richard Schwartz, who came up with IFS, internal family systems, because they're like, you kind of don't give us credit for it, which is really interesting. So there is little backlash on there, but I think it's almost like reclaiming and making it, like, if we're practicing and making it our own and being like, a lot of people do see indigenous practice and spirituality as kind of woo-woo, right? Mm-hmm. So like, it's almost like bringing it, reclaiming it back and being like, this is mind, body, and spirit. We're using it all, right? He just kind of made it into a more, I guess, he is a white man, and they take it more into a validating kind of theory, right? But still, it's amazing. I think I use it a lot because I love the what it stands for of you have all these parts of you, but if you make a mistake or one part of you is, let's say, maybe the perfectionism or wants control because of your anxiety, it doesn't say that that is who you are as a person. It doesn't define you as an identity, right? So maybe we can just like talk to this part of you, be interested in what it needs, to say, and go from there. But there are so many parts of you, so many beautiful as a whole, as a self. And I think that's what sometimes people need to hear, of like, this action or this part of me doesn't define me and validate it. It's there to protect me. It's there to help me survive, you know? And I think a lot of people need to hear that. And once they have that, they're more open to being, okay, let me be curious about it, because it's not unsafe to be this person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Identifying with that one little part is what we end up doing. And, this fits really well with Jungian theory, which is basically that from a young age, the conditioning from Carl Jung, how he described it, was that we start to split ourselves into the ego and the shadow. And so the ego, all of our traits and personality that was accepted on some level and that brought us safety goes into the ego. So the only thing that the ego is consumed with is basically our safety. We're kind of talking about the nervous system too here.
Exactly.
And then, well, if you're going to say that I am this, you have to know what you're not. And so it automatically, just by default, will then put the opposite of those traits into the shadow. And that doesn't mean that there's a bunch of negative connotation, you know, based traits in the shadow. Oh. There's a bunch of beautiful things. Like we were talking about being able to express ourselves authentically. A lot of those parts of ourselves are actually in the shadow. Some people call them the light shadow to sort of differentiate it, but it's really just called the shadow because it's a dark place that we actually disown in a way, but it's parts.
In IFS, it's called exiled.
Oh, so it's perfect. It's literally the same. And so I don't know if IFS talks about this. Carl Jung talked about how when traits get put into the shadow, we exile them and we actually kind of dissociate from them. So it's like, we don't know, we're not consciously aware that they're there. So that's the other thing. Yeah. The shadow is our unconscious. It's what we don't think is actually a part of us. And what happens to those traits, so I want to know if this is this kind of what they say, what happens to those traits is that they sort of like take on a personality of their own. And so they, in a weird way, like we think that they're just rendered harmless in the shadow, but actually it's the opposite. They gain a lot of energy and they become almost like their own beings, their own personalities, which then it ends up looking like sabotage, but it's like they have their wants and needs as well. And honestly, they're an important part of us. And so they end up like popping up when we least want them to be there. And so a classic example is when somebody will have like an angry outburst and then afterwards they'll say, no, that wasn't me. I mean, how many times have we said that, right? Oh, I'm so sorry. That wasn't actually me. That's like almost a classic example of, okay, that was a shadow character. You actually don't think it's you at all, but it is.
Yep. Exactly. That's exactly the same. It's like a part of you, right? That was got triggered. And it's like so many layers that we could think about. It got triggered somehow. That person felt unsafe, so they logically couldn't reason out, so a part of them came out, got triggered, and said something, but also it doesn't define them, right? It's not who they are. And it's really, they really do say that. They're like, it's not who I am, I just said it, because it really is. It was just it's just like instinct, right? It just happened and you have an angry outburst. But then when you take a step back and reflect and be like, was that really me? Did I really feel that? Or was it just because I was triggered and I couldn't, and I just felt like I had to almost like fight my way through it, right? Yeah. That's the response. Of
defend something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is where it's also interesting because it's like our entirety is not wrapped up in this one identity. But at the same time, this little part of us actually has a lot of qualities that we want to be able to embody and express in the world. If we're able to, and we recognize that it's just a part, it allows us to bring our purpose forward. It allows us to embody things or experience things that we really want to experience. So we can't like eradicate these parts. We don't want to eradicate these parts of ourselves, right? But again, I guess we're going back to the befriending.
when we
befriend them, then they're kind of like on our side, so to speak, I guess you could say. And we can actually express ourselves in ways that we wouldn't be able to. We can make connections maybe that we really want that we weren't able to before. We can go places. I mean, this is why I was so connected to this work, because honestly, after a while, it becomes really fun.
It does.
I think that classically people think of counseling and even coaching as, like our most negative thoughts. What I have thought in the past is like, I'm so messed up that I need this. This is not going to be fun. This is something that unfortunately I need. Mm-hmm. And if we flip the script, actually counseling and coaching is supposed to be bringing these parts together and allowing us to be our most authentic self, which is really fun.
It really is.
The process has its ups and downs, of course. It's not always going to be fun, the process, but the end goal of it, the result of it is, I guess I'm bringing the word fun up because I feel like we sort of take fun as just this word that's like, it doesn't mean much, but really it does. Like, I do think that a part of us being here is that we're supposed to enjoy ourselves and, you know, find things that bring us joy.
And I think when you say fun, to me, it reminds me of play, right?
Yeah,
and it's like you're able to just do things that really nourish you, that make you feel happy, that make you feel safe. And that's where the creative expression comes. You start being a childlike again, but it's like really like you are your authentic self, and it's a transformation. And like you're saying, counseling and coaching is super, super impactful. And that's what it's about. It's about your transformation. And yes, sometimes it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to be things that you maybe don't want to come up, right? Because you've been avoiding for so long, but the end goal is really beautiful and really feels worth it to go through.
Yeah, you know what I always think about? Because everyone talks about how, inner work is so hard. But, you know, at some point, not doing inner work is really hard. You know?
It's harder.
It's hard. At some point, it is totally harder. Come on. Nobody wants to be, going in and out of emotions of anxiety and depression. That's what happened to me, And I'm not alone, right? I mean, that is like the story of most people. Nobody wants to be in burnout for years on end, but it happens. And that's hard. It is so hard to be in those states.
Very, very true. Yes.
Have you listened to a lot of Brené Brown? I mean, I know she's so popular, but.
For sure. Okay. Yeah. I have many books of her, and I used to listen to her more, but haven't lately, but I used to listen to her podcast.
Yeah. I love her. And so you were talking about play, and she brings up, has done a lot of research on, of course, like shame, vulnerability, and all of that. But in the process of that, she has started to put together a theory of what people have in common who she calls the wholehearted. So she's coined that word, but from what I have heard of her talk about that word, I see it as just somebody who has been able to sort of bring these parts together, have a more regulated nervous system, everything that we're kind of talking about, which you can sort of achieve through coaching or counseling. But also on your own, right? I mean, these are things that we can achieve. Yeah. Like, we are meant to be able to work through these as human beings. And so that's my gist of what wholehearted are. But one of the things she found in common was that she said wholehearted people play. And she, like, they make time, or like that is what they do, like on a regular basis, like they play. And she, I'm not going to get all of the points, but she had like a list of what she found out through her research, what characterized play as. And it was definitely, it was like an activity that you can get lost in that you're not self-conscious about. Oh, what else? So I can't remember the other ones that she characterized them as.
Okay.
But I'll have to look it up if I remember. I'll put it in the podcast notes. But it was so important. It was so interesting because she brought up the point that we often as adults have this mentality that you can only play once you've done enough work. Like, I mean, it's kind of like the work hard, play hard, but a lot of us, part of our narrative is that we never work hard enough. So we never get to that place that where we give our permission to ourselves to actually play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that feeds into our society with capitalism, right? The individualism, like if you don't work as hard, you're not going to get to that place. Right. And it's just like perpetuating this thing that wants us to be with a dysregulated nervous system. It really does. Right.
And what's so interesting is that a dysregulated nervous system is not often the best tool to get things done, right? Because it is just obsessed with keeping you safe. So I would say every single job to be the most effective and to actually get the results that you want, being in the rest and digest state is where you're going to get those.
Yeah. That's where you're going to make the best ideas. You're going to work the best. You're going to be able to talk the best, reason, maybe find a different way, a solution. Like, that's amazing. But we're so stuck in this capitalistic world of like work that we're in this constant flight or fight state pretty much all the time. And I've been even seeing some patients that are getting obsessed with healing. Also, it's like almost the same concept.
I just wrote a post about this. Oh my God.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah, because it's like really like they're so obsessed of like, I'm doing the journaling, doing that. And it's like goes back to like, go out and have fun, go play, because that's actually going to probably be more helpful than you doing all the things and getting so like anal about, I have to do all this stuff.
That's so funny.
To feel better.
I definitely fell into that for a while where I got so obsessed with like this, you know, this work and on myself. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I realized that I had this belief that I wouldn't be able to do any of the things that I wanted to do until I was like completely healed, which, you know, is impossible, right? I mean, we spend, that's the whole point of our lives. Like it comes slowly and we're constantly going to be working on this. We will never get to a point where suddenly we've healed all of our conditioning and we are like our most authentic self 24/7. But I realized, oh my gosh, I have this limiting belief where I really feel like I can't live my life. Like I've put my life on hold in a way until I have done all the work. Yeah. And this is again where that belief gives me anxiety, right?
Yeah,
that belief puts me into fight or flight. Yeah.
Yeah. So true.
That's so funny.
You just made a post about it.
I did. Yeah. I think I called it something like, yes, you can get addicted to inner work. And I mean, I wrote it from experience. Like that definitely happened to me. And I started to realize that, oh my gosh. Okay. So part of this inner work is actually getting to the point where you're able to let go and enjoy things. And that is what you do with a regulated nervous system. Like you are able to say, okay, you know, I'm done for now. What do I want to do? You know, I think I want to go and like have a picnic. You go and do it. And you're present. You're in the moment. You can, you know, enjoy yourself. And that being in that state, I truly believe helps us with our purpose. You know, that's the only, like, that's the energy that's going to propel us and bring things, attract things to us, opportunities that are best for us. Actually, one thing that has really helped me has been breath work. We haven't talked about this yet. You brought up some awesome other ones that were super easy, like the gargling. What were the other ones just to,
for the humming, it's gargling, humming, and singing, because it actually activates your vagus nerve than what we talked about. And so that's why it puts you into a more, parasympathetic
rest and digest. Awesome. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that you can do is, breath pacing, because like we were saying, when you're in the fight or flight and freeze, right? Like there's a certain pattern of breathing that our nervous system puts us in when we are in those states. And so it's the only thing that we can also, like, we can't really consciously control our heart rate, right?
Exactly.
There are things that we can't actually consciously control, but our breathing we can control. So it's almost like a backdoor into slowly re-regulating our nervous system. And a couple of the ways that we breathe when we're in parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest part of parasympathetic, is longer exhales than inhales, or the same, but I think usually it's like the at least a little longer exhale, and then belly breathing. And weirdly enough, not focusing on breathing super deep, but focusing on slowing the breath down. Almost to the point, like when I first started doing this breath work. So what I did was I would do 4 seconds in, and I started with 5 seconds out, but then I go now to 6 seconds out, but it was too hard for me at first. Yeah. The 4 seconds in was okay. The 6 seconds out was way too long.
Yeah. And this is kind of, you have to kind of do it with like a straw. That's what they say. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It is so hard. And this is where, you know, mm-hmm. when that is so hard for you, it probably, like for me, it was definitely an indication that my nervous system was pretty dysregulated. Like, and that was clear from other signs too, but mm-hmm. slowly, I started out with like 5 minutes a day, which again, to start out was really hard. Like it was so hard for me to do even like the 4 seconds in, 5 seconds out. And then I moved it up to like 7 minutes a day. And basically what I do now is I do about 20 minutes a day. And I know some people do 20 minutes twice a day, which is supposed to be the best. But I at least do 20 minutes once a day. And I find such a difference when I kind of fall off that and I stop doing it. And then mm-hmm. when I start doing it again. And
yeah,
I mean, throughout the day, I am able to be calmer when certain things come up mm-hmm. and to be more present, to be able to actually deal with it in a constructive way. And what I like about that is at first it was so horrible. I hated it. But after a while, when you start, mm-hmm. it does take a while, but when you start to see, to feel yourself relaxing through it and afterwards, then you start to look forward to it. I think that's the best part.
Because it becomes a practice, right?
Yeah.
And I totally can relate on that too, because I've always had digestive issues, and I've also realized that I hold my breath a lot. And with belly breathing, you really have to feel your belly expand. And it was so helpful. I was like, I haven't been breathing correctly for how long? For so many years, right? And it was super, super helpful to do that. And then I also took a neuroscientist course of like just to figure out like neuroscience, and like she was really into breath work as well. And I don't know if you've heard of the physiological sigh. Does that sound familiar?
I don't think
so. It's almost the same thing of taking two quick inhales and then a longer exhale. So it's two quick inhales and then at least like 5 to 8 seconds exhale, which is a longer exhale, right? To get you into that mode. But there's so much research on that has shown, like, it's like a, it's almost, I think it's coined by someone at this point, but there's so much research on this physiological side that has helped people get into like more of a parasympathetic mode, and like able to just reason better and able to do just get into the state that they're able to function. And I recommend it a lot with my patients when they're like super triggered, you know, or they're in the middle of a fight or like disagreement with even their partner. Just do that breath work and then come back and talk about it, right? Just do 5 rounds of those, and it's immediately like gets you into that mode. It's really crazy how breath work can be so amazing.
I know. Oh, I like that too, because I know that there are quite a few different paces that you can use. They talk about the breath box, I think, which is the 4 seconds in, then you hold it for 4 seconds, 4 seconds out, then you hold it for 4 seconds. And yeah, I would suggest like figure out which one you kind of works for you and then try them out. Like I have tried different ones out. Right now I do more of the 4 in, 6 out, but I'm going to try that one next time.
Yeah.
Because I have not done that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Look into the research. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. Awesome. I will. Okay, so I feel like we can start wrapping it up a bit. Any like last kind of comments or thoughts that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I guess a thing that I did want to bring up is, you know, it's really hard to afford counselor, therapist, coach. They're really expensive. And so I just feel like people are usually like, so what do I do if I can't afford a therapist or I can't... I don't have this resource, right? And I think it's really important to realize that you can find safety in many things. And I think we idolize like, you know, going and doing yoga, going outside to the park and having your coffee, like, you know, this idolization of like what healing and safety can look like. But you can find safety in so many little ways. And I think I want to just preface that, what if you visualize safety or feel what safety is? Like, if you have like a family member that you usually talk to, a family member that you connect to, or if there's a place that you feel like is your safety or you dream of being there, and it's more about the feeling of that thing that brings you safety, and imagine it when you need it, because you don't need to go anywhere. You don't need to go buy anything. You don't need to do anything necessarily. You just need to feel what that safety feels like in your body, the sensation, the temperature. And when you feel like you need a resource, so that's what we call them resources, like safety resources. When you feel like your nervous system is dysregulated and you're in the state, just go back to that feeling, sensation of safety, and see if you could give that to yourself at that moment.
That is so important. I'm so happy that you brought that up. And one, you're totally right. There are we feel like we need so much money, or everything's so expensive, because everything is.
It is.
But there are things that you can do. And so this is like, YouTube has been amazing for me. Even like yoga, like you were saying, there are so many amazing people who are doing free videos with yoga online. I mean, it's incredible. And two, I'm glad you brought up the imagination. I read somewhere that when we imagine things, our brain actually doesn't quite know. So this can actually work in the opposite effect too, but our brain doesn't know. It takes it as reality. Like our imagination is something. Yeah. When we imagine it, our body reacts in the same way as if it happened in front of our face. And you can test this, right? Like how many times have you thought of a scary situation happening or a sad situation, and your body will literally have the responses it would have.
Totally. There's actually a paper on it. I don't know if you saw this, but it's amazing. It's they did three groups of showing how to play the piano.
I think I did see this.
Uh-huh. And there's a group of like, they didn't do anything. There was the group of actually doing the piano, and then the one imagining to play the piano, and the people that actually did play the piano and imagined it were both able to play the piano beautifully. I thought that was incredible.
It's insane. And they've done other studies on that. I don't think I heard of that study, but I've heard of where they did it like with golf, basketball. Yes. They've done it with other things, especially sports. Because they're using it with sports teams now, where they will actually like have them imagine things.
And, or imagine the worst case scenario, and what would you do if that happened?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that happened with Michael Phelps. Like, what if his glasses got like messed up or something, and it actually happened, but he was so poised and was able to finish because he already had imagined what he would do and how it would feel if he continued to go. So it's pretty amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah. And so I really like that, just being able to imagine a place where you feel safe, or with a person. Or I used to imagine my cat sometimes, because when she was like curled up on my chest, she would make me feel safe, that kind of thing. And it also brings an important point where it's, which I think this is where we can bring some self-empowerment into it. It's when you know that you can achieve that state by your imagination, then it proves that the safety is not actually in that other thing externally. It is actually in you. You're the one who is creating that response. So that's where perception comes in. That's why for some people, the same scenario, even like, let's say they were younger, right? With minimal conditioning, the same scenario will put one person into a fight or flight and one person won't. It's because they're perceiving it a certain way. So it really is coming from them, which is super empowering, because that means that we are not beholden to all of these external things. It really puts it back into our own hands. And that means we can work with it, and that we can learn how to regulate our own nervous system. We don't actually need all of these external things, even though, you know, still like having something like this is where it's like, we're still human and we are still interacting with the world. So it's like, we still have our own coaches and therapists, right? You and I.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's so important. Sure. Like I, that is so important to me, because I think we can help each other, and that's just how we function. But the truth is that, you know, we do have that empowerment in ourselves.
Very true. Yeah. Very well said. I like that. I love that reminder of the self-empowerment, because that's what it's about at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. This was awesome. And I feel like I would love to have you back sometime to talk about, I don't know, just some other things.
There's so much more. I feel like it's so much. Gone.
I know. So many tangents. So we'll have to come back and talk about some other things for sure.
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here and for talking about your expertise and all of your knowledge and all that. It was so awesome.
Yeah, and yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. Welcome. And hopefully I'll be able to talk to you again on this podcast.
Yes. Should I say where to reach me?
Yes. Oh, that was the other thing. So I will link information in the podcast.
Perfect. Okay.
Yeah. Caption. But is there anything else that you wanted to let people know?
I guess I am still, accepting patients. If you guys are, interested, I can reach me on Instagram, which is at Dr.Francis Martinez. And then also you could just go to my website and schedule there, but yeah.
Perfect. And then I'll have both of those down below too. So you can go down there and, and get all the awesome information from Dr. Perfect. Francis.
Thank you so much.
Okay, great. And everybody listening, thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
If you would like to try Jungian mind-body coaching to address core condition patterns and pursuit of your best life, and or are interested in my burnout recovery program, check out my website in the description box and sign up for a free discovery call to learn more. I would love to meet and talk with you about your struggles, goals, and how we can work together to accomplish your dreams. Until next time, this is your host, Katarina, owner of Forest Path Mind Body Medicine.